Hello, Peoria. It's WAZU. This is Solidarity Journal. It's Tuesday, May 3rd. As always, I'm in the studio with Mike, but we have a special guest, Rachel.
Hi, I'm Rachel. I go to ICC. I'm studying biology, and later on I'll be going over the topic of what the ego is.
Mike, what do you got for us today?
Over the weekend, I was up in Forest Park, Illinois, at the cemetery there, which has the martyrs from the Haymarket massacre from 1886.
That's awesome. I look forward to both of your guys' informational pieces. These are your headlines. Did anybody miss the after rally in East Peoria concerning the contract crafted between local newsmakers and the owners of the network? We've got you covered on that if you missed it. Peoria Heights and Forest Park Nature Center celebrated Earth Day a little late this year. Last Saturday, April 30th, the Solidarity Journal attended and met a great many organizations with the audacity to change the way we live by encouraging us to be more sustainable. We'll introduce you to CICarpool.org. You won't want to miss that. And a local woman and friend of Peoria Area Peace Network just got back to the States from a trip to Pakistan. We'll tell you about her, and she'll tell us her story. Mike's May Day Haymarket first-hand report is coming up as well. Here at the Solidarity Journal, we're pleased to introduce Rachel. She'll hopefully be contributing to the show's quality for months to come. Today she'll be delivering a report on the human ego, as she said, as she mentioned. You can't live with it and you can't live without it. As always, we'll have general pro-union, pro-student talks and views. Thanks for tuning in. As always, this is WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica Radio affiliate. Stay tuned. Razia Ahmed, born in Pakistan, raised in India, and came to the United States in 1970 as a graduate student. She has a doctorate in chemistry. She's a retired local teacher who taught at ICC. She's a proud member of the Peoria Area Peace Network. At 65, she recently made a five-month trip to Pakistan, visiting Lahore, Islamabad, Karachi, and many other areas, all while helping flood victims. With donations from U.S. citizens, she did this all on her own. Her efforts were not affiliated with any active NGO or charity, while she did work alongside international NGOs and charities. Recently, she spoke on cable public access television channel 22 on the Peoria Peace Beat show. Solidarity Journal was in attendance at the filming. We have details and some of the most interesting clips from that show. Peoria Peace Beat is hosted by Doug Thompson and has been for over 20 years. In that time, they have used channel 22 to promote awareness and truth. We thank them.
And just to give you, give the audience a little history about yourself, you're from Pakistan originally?
Yes.
Okay, you were born in India?
Right.
Raised in Pakistan. And then when did you come to the United States?
I came to the United States in 1970 as a graduate student.
Okay. Mm. And your history as far as your profession, what do you do or what have you done for?
Well, I had a degree in chemistry, and okay. I worked as a chemist for several years, and then I also taught part-time at ICC.
Okay, good. And, of course, being from Pakistan, you still have family there.
I have all my family from in Georgia.
Large family?
Yes. We are seven brothers and sisters, and both my parents have passed away, and but we have extended family, big, big family.
Okay. And you have children yourself, son and daughter?
Yes,
okay.
I have.
How long have you lived in Peoria? What's your...
I moved in Peoria in 1992 from Florida.
And have been here pretty much ever since?
Ever since. This is more my home than any other place.
Great. And I should say also Razia is active in some of the local peace groups and environmental groups, I guess you could say. And has been really at the forefront of a lot of things that are happening in Peoria. But tonight we're going to talk about Pakistan. Like you said, you have family there, so that would be a reason to go back. But you actually had more of an impetus than that to return this time.
Right. I had some relatives, my nephews and nieces getting married. Mm-hmm. And also I've been wanting to go to work with the flood, victims of the flood, because you know, in June or July of 2010, there was huge, huge flood that started in one at one end of the country and went all the way down to the other end.
Monsoon rain and record-breaking rainfall laid waste to the people and infrastructure of Pakistan from north to south. Life was dramatically affected.
See, on the east side, it shares border, long border with India, starting from up northwest Kashmir to the northeast, to the, down to the Indian Ocean. And on the other side, it has a long border with Afghanistan. And since 9/11, India has been very active in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So you may know India and Pakistan traditionally.
India or Pakistan or both?
India and Pakistan had not so friendly relationships. Before 1947, there was no Pakistan. So Pakistan,
it was like all India otherwise?
Yes, all India.
Okay.
And Pakistan was carved out of, and in fact, to begin with, there were two parts. One was called East Pakistan, the other one was West Pakistan. East Pakistan was on the other side of India. It's southeast of India.
The Islamic faith was a huge uniting factor in the history of Pakistan becoming what it is today, in terms of geography.
Was never happy with the partition, and some factions of Indian... Indians never accepted Pakistan.
Sure.
And so they're always, they said, you know, at the time of the partition, Pakistan didn't have anything. Mm-hmm. No army, no treasury. There was just, so they said it will disintegrate in 25 years. Mm-hmm. So that, it's a miracle that Pakistan survived.
Sure.
Yeah. So, but India never gave up on, or some, I can't say all of Indians are like that, but some segments mm-hmm. are still dreaming of uniting with India.
Oh, okay, sure.
History proves India and Pakistani relationships are pretty weak.
There was a, they say, dam broke in Kabul, and also Indus River, and then there was monsoon rains. And there was, Nowshera was flooded, drowned, in fact, they said.
But I mean, this was caused by a natural disaster.
Yeah, well, there is...
Oh, no.
There is,
it wasn't like a hurricane or something?
Some people say, as I said, India is all over Afghanistan.
Uh-huh.
Some people, I've heard rumors, I cannot confirm them, that India broke the dam of Kabul River.
Huh. A bit of a conspiracy theory, though.
Yeah, well, and monsoon rains. And
but yeah, you still had the rains, though.
Yeah, the rains.
But no, nothing like a hurricane or tornado or...
No, it was so bad. In fact, if I can show you map again. So the flood started up here. The River Kabul coming from Afghanistan and River Indus coming from up Gilgit or Kashmir meet around Nowshera. They flow side by side and then they mixed, become one flow. And then it came all the way down through Punjab and Sindh.
Okay.
And there's the Indian Ocean here.
Okay.
Arabian Sea, I'm sorry.
Sure.
So Nowshera up there kind of drowned. I was there, I went to, we can talk about that later too, but I went there just before coming back to the United States. And we went to one school. The headmaster showed us the the water level. On the second floor, 2 feet above the second floor, the water reached and stayed there for 8 days. And there, everything was washed away.
Two major rivers flooded, and a dam break with speculation to its destruction. All of this coupled with monsoon rains have devastated Pakistan.
this is the just shows you the flood from one end of the country to the other end.
Do you have any idea of the loss of life?
I do not know exactly, but the loss of life was relatively less relatively speaking. Like, we lost 80,000 when the earthquake came in Pakistan, in Kashmir. There were a few hundreds. I'm not sure exactly how many, but there were like 20 million people displaced.
Sure.
Yeah. See, it took several months, in fact, a couple of months at least, from one end to the other end. I went to Sindh 6 months after that. I was there in January, so there was still water standing there.
Okay.
Some people, the villages, and I heard horrible stories. People were saying all the bodies and the cattle were flowing, running down the stream. Some went to their relatives, but then a lot of them were in tents, and by the time I got there, they had, most of them, majority of them, have gone back to wherever. But in Sindh, there were still a lot of people living in tents.
Sindh was one of the most displaced communities, according to Dr. Ahmed. She decided to attend to her native people with her own resources, rather than donate money to an international organization.
As we had experienced after the earthquake in Haiti, we all contributed, and then we found out that our contributions were not reaching the people. Mm. So I did not contribute to anything to the floods because I wanted to go and see for myself and see what their needs are. And more important for me, to meet the people. So, but I found out it was not so easy to go to the people. My sister is a teacher in Tarbela, that's about 120 kilometers from Islamabad, west of Islamabad. Colleagues from Sawat and Nowshera and places like that. So I asked her to talk around and see if there is somebody who knows people in the flooded area. And there was a problem because the roads were all washed away. There was no means of transportation. People would go in army helicopters and stuff. But my sister found someone, and he was working with these flood victims, with NGOs. So he suggested that I go to Sindh. Sindh is a province, Sindh is the south.
Okay,
Karachi is the biggest city of Sindh.
Sure, okay.
So I did not know anybody in the flooded area, but I have a brother who lives in Karachi. So I said, I'll go to Karachi. So I went to Karachi to go to Sindh. I didn't want to help urban areas. I wanted to go to places where, the help is difficult to reach.
Mm-hmm.
People don't know about it. So I really was looking for people who were left out of this help, big help thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the only place they said was to go to Sindh.
Okay.
You know, they always have NGOs coming there.
Sure.
And they were arranging for my car to take me to places. I said, I can't afford to take cars because, it would 5,000 rupees for one day. I said, all my money would be gone that way. I just didn't want to go there, talk to people and come back. In fact, I wanted to go and spend some time with this. It's not easy to go to the flooded areas.
Okay.
But I was looking for somebody who would do it economically. And I didn't want them to know, to think I have a lot of money and I can just, there are a lot of places where you can spend that money. There are a lot of causes, a lot of poverty, a lot of projects going where you could spend money, no problem.
Finding the most use for the money she had was a difficult task.
UNICEF, in fact, Save the Children, a section of UNICEF, Red Cross, Oxfam. See, they were active all over. It was exceptionally cold for that area. Mm. Normally it's not that cold, and these people were sitting out in the kind of open almost. Mm. So we asked them what they needed, and there were a lot of complaints about food, not getting food, and these two young women said no, they got food. There was some kind of not proper coordination between these international agencies. They come and donate things to people, but there's no central unit that keeps track of who gets what.
Sure.
So we did not know, or they did not know either, if those people were telling the truth or lies. So they said they didn't have food for 3 months.
Sure.
So now we were deciding what to do. I was thinking, what should I do with the money I have? So buy them food, or then they also said they didn't have warm clothes, blankets. The USAID was working there too. They give them blankets. They called government, Pakistani government blankets, very, very thin. Mm-hmm. Not, they didn't like those blankets at all. So we were thinking now, what should I do? So these girls, we came back to the office, and Sir Ali promised that he'll look into the food situation, so I don't need to worry about the food. Mm-hmm. If they didn't get food, he'll make sure they get food. Okay. So okay, so we decided to give them thick, we have a lot of Korean blankets, thick ones, mm-hmm. They're very much light. But we had to go to Sakhar now. Sakhar is like 40 kilometers from Shikarpur.
Okay.
So we go to Sakhar, there we decide that Korean blankets were expensive.
Okay.
So they're like, there are 250 families there.
Uh-huh.
And the money I had, Tanya's money and my own money, I bought 150 quilts.
Okay.
Instead of blankets. Quilts were a little bit cheaper, and also I like quilts better than blankets. They feel
colorful,
warmer
too.
And little quilts, and they were cotton.
She ended up working alongside and with some of the organizational players of some smaller NGOs and community resource groups. Estimates are that she took $60,000 with her and spent it all in ways that helped individuals, which she saw to completion. Helping each individual she came across, all the money for her efforts she raised within the Peoria community. The floods of 2010 in her homeland, Pakistan, rose in her desire to stand up. She couldn't sit idly by. Her motivation was built right here in central Illinois. It was funded and planned right here in our home. While Peoria might not seem like it, within it are the seeds of great opportunity. If she can do something this big, we surely all can do a little more.
Thank you.
This past Sunday was May 1st, and most people living in the United States know little about the International Workers' Day of May Day. Most Americans don't realize that May Day has its origins here in this country. In the late 19th century, the working class was in constant struggle to gain the 8-hour workday. Working conditions were severe, and it was quite common to work 10 to 16 hours a day in unsafe conditions. As early as the 1860s, working people agitated to shorten the workday without a cut in pay, but it wasn't until the late 1880s that organized labor was able to garner enough strength to declare the 8-hour workday. This proclamation was without consent of employers, yet demanded by many of the working class. At this time, socialism was a new and attractive idea to working people, many of whom were drawn to its ideology of working class control over the production and distribution of all goods and services. Workers had seen firsthand that capitalism benefited only their bosses, trading workers' lives for profit. Thousands of men, women, and children were dying needlessly every year in the workplace, with life expectancy as low as their early 20s in some industries, and little hope but death of rising out of their destitution. Socialism offered another option. Tens of thousands of socialists broke ranks from their parties, rebuffed the entire political process, which was seen as nothing more than protection for the wealthy, and created anarchist groups throughout the country. Literally, thousands of working people embraced the ideals of anarchism, which sought to put an end to all hierarchical structures, including government, which emphasized worker-controlled industry and valued direction, action over the bureaucratic political process. An estimated 250,000 workers in the Chicago area became directly involved in the crusade to implant the 8-hour workday, including the Trade and Labor Assembly, the Socialistic Labor Party, and local Knights of Labor. As more and more of the workforce mobilized against the employers, these radicals conceded to fight for the 8-hour workday. With the involvement of the anarchists, there seemed to be an infusion of greater issues than the 8-hour workday, though. There grew a sense of a greater social revolution beyond the more immediate gains of shortened hours, but a drastic change in the economic structure of capitalism. These struggles were eventually recognized worldwide after the Haymarket Massacre.
We are seeing the birth of a new international trade union movement. We have the Transport and General Workers Union and Amicus joined together. They have now joined with the steel workers of America. And if we are going to defeat big business, we have got to have global unions working for people in every country in the world who face the same problems that workers face here.
On Sunday, May 1st, in Forest Park, Illinois, at the Forest Home Cemetery, cars lined up and down the road, with people filing out with signs of solidarity and pro-union messages. Police were directing traffic, circling the block in their squad cars, eyeing unionists, anarchists, and others who made their way to the middle of the cemetery. What had summoned all of us there this day was to preserve the power of the labor movement. The symbol of this preservation stood not far from us, which was a monument covered with a red and black flag, with the grave sites of those who sacrificed everything. And surrounding them, in remembrance, was the martyrs of the Haymarket Massacre. Almost 1,000 unionists, activists, and government officials gathered behind me, waiting for the unveiling of the statue that has gone under restoration, which was made possible by the Illinois Labor History Society. Beforehand, speakers took to the stage, speaking the revitalization of the labor movement and how it has grown. Terrence O'Sullivan, General President, Labor's Union, spoke of militancy that is needed within the movement.
Thank you, Bob. It's really it's an honor for me to be here today with all the dedicated and committed trade unionists from across the great state of Illinois. And it's always an honor for me to be with my proud, strong, united, and orange brothers and sisters of the Laborers International Union of North America. I want to especially recognize we have two great vice presidents in the state, Terry Healy and John Penn, that are here. And along with all these distinguished speakers and guests, it also is a privilege to be here with Liz Schuler, the Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, and Jim Williams, the General President of the Painters and Allied Trades. Brothers and sisters, today we have paid our respects to those who made the ultimate sacrifice in the struggle for dignity and justice for working men and women. Times have changed since the Haymarket Eight faced the batons and bullets. But brothers and sisters, our struggle for workers' rights goes on. Just as the men and women of Haymarket stood united and stood fearless in the face of corporate terror, today we must stand united and stand fearless in the face of corporate tyranny. Now, as then, we are fighting for the basic fundamental rights and freedoms of every working men and women to join together for strength, to join together for justice, and to unite together to improve the lives of all working people. More than a century after the birth of the American labor movement, working men and women are still fighting for the most basic of rights. That right to join, unite together, and join a union is what struck fear in the heart of the Pinkertons and robber barons. And it's the same right that clowns like Scott Walker, the Koch brothers, and their corporate-backed allies want to crush today. But I know we're sure as hell not going to let that happen, brothers and sisters. Instead of being at the wrong end of a Pinkerton's baton, working men and women today are at the wrong end of a lawmaker's gavel or a governor's pen. Targets of wealthy special interests who don't want us standing in the way of their greedy agenda. Millions of Americans are jobless. Families are losing their homes, their hopes, and their dreams. And all the while, the rich get richer and blame working people for the economic crisis that they created. The immorality of those who oppose the 8-hour day more than 100 years ago is the same immorality we face today with those who oppose collective bargaining, those that oppose prevailing wage, and those that oppose anything and everything that is good for working men and women.
That's right.
The Haymarket Uprising is the birth of the real Labor Day in America and across the globe. It marks a turning point when workers of all creeds united together as one to secure their rightful place in our society. Of the Haymarket Eight, only one was born in America. Many of the men and women who peacefully gathered in the square that day were immigrant workers. They came to America because of its hope, because of its promise, and because of its opportunity for a better, safer, and more dignified way of life. Today, an increasing number of workers in America are just like those of Haymarket. Whether they are immigrants who are here seeking a better life or native workers who are struggling just to hold on. At the time, Haymarket was seen as a defeat for labor. We know it was only the beginning of a saga that would culminate decades later in strikes, in pickets, in other demonstrations of activism that gave workers real power. We must constantly remind ourselves that the death of the labor movement has been predicted time and time again, from Haymarket to today, and every time we have fought back and become stronger. We see this happening right now around the country. The enemies of working people are on the attack in state houses all around America. But they are also unifying and energizing working people in ways we haven't seen in decades. The workers who died in the chaos at Haymarket and the four who were unjustly executed deserve to see their cause live on. And brothers and sisters, it must live on through each and every one of us here today. From Illinois to Wisconsin, across the Midwest and across America, we must not mourn. We must continue to organize. We must continue to agitate and excite our members and working people throughout this country. And we must continue to fight for the rights of all working men and women in our country. Some would fear or shy away from commemorating Haymarket. Some would say that what it represents is too radical, a movement too militant. But then, as now, when basic freedoms and rights are under attack, when those that have power try to destroy dignity and make a mockery of what our nation stands for, when we're fighting just to hold on to our very lives, there is no movement too radical, and there is no movement too militant. You stand on hallowed ground today. Ground that holds the blood, the tears, and victories of generations. We vow to always remember the sacrifices of the Haymarket martyrs, just as we will remember the tens of thousands of men and women who have occupied state capitals in Madison, in Indianapolis, and in Ohio, and other cities across this country. We commit ourselves to the rights of all workers, immigrant or native born, and recommit ourselves to our unions and to our movement. We will honor in actions and deeds the principles of the Pledge of Allegiance, which we must forever remind corporate America does not state liberty and justice for some, it states liberty and justice for all. So brothers and sisters, today we rededicate ourselves to a radical and militant movement that never backs up and never backs down in the fight for human rights, for civil rights, for labor rights, and for workers' rights. And I know that as we leave here today, arm in arm, shoulder to shoulder, united in mission and purpose, we will continue to honor the martyrs of Haymarket. And together as trade unionists, we will stand together, we will fight together, and we will change the course, the direction, and the destiny of our unions, of our movement, and of our country. God bless you, brothers and sisters.
Also, Illinois Supreme Court Chief Justice Thomas Kilbride made an appearance, taking to the microphone and standing with the unions in solidarity.
Anyone that knows the story of Haymarket knows that that trial was conducted to silence working men and women, to silence them for what they were looking to achieve, and that was rights for everyone. In 1886, justice failed the men buried here today. Fortunately for us today, we have honorable men like Illinois Supreme Court Justice Thomas Kilbride, who respect the law that it is designed to protect. And despite the best efforts of the right wing, today I bring you Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court, Tom Kilbride.
I don't know if that band's available to go down to court next week. Today, we gather here not only to honor those who bore the sacrifice of Haymarket in 1886, but also to remind ourselves that our American system and our American liberties must always be defended. As Americans, we have a right to assemble peacefully. As Americans, we have a right to free speech. Those basic rights were not respected in 1886 in Haymarket Square, resulting in the tragedy that we remember today. As Americans, we are also entitled to a judicial system that is fair and equitable, where everyone is innocent until proven guilty, where everyone is allowed a fair trial before a jury of one's peers. In 1893, while it was unpopular, our Illinois governor, John Peter Altgeld, pardoned the remaining three men convicted after Haymarket, believing that the Haymarket defendants did not receive a fair trial and did not stand before an impartial jury. Altgeld knew that without faith in a fair and impartial jury, an impartial judiciary, the people would lose faith in their democratic institutions. As Altgeld said in 1893 in his pardon message, he would have not issued the pardon if there had been a fair trial. And Altgeld said, and I quote, "No matter what the defendants were charged with, they were entitled to a fair trial. And no greater danger could possibly threaten our institutions than to have the courts of justice run wild or give way to popular clamor." Close quote. There is a lesson from Haymarket. If our nation is to survive, everyone must stand before the courts, considered innocent until proven guilty. Everyone, whether immigrant or native born, is entitled to basic American justice and an impartial judge and jury. Let us learn from Haymarket. Learn to listen to the quiet voice of reason. Learn that our courts work best when they're insulated from the moment's popular cry. Let us value those freedoms and ensure our judicial system always remains fair for all, no matter race, class, gender, national origin, or background. Thank you.
Many other union activists, presidents, and directors went on to denounce the recent attacks against unions and the working class citizens, especially those that I've witnessed personally firsthand in Madison, Wisconsin. Each speaker reminded the people that what had brought them all there today, and that was what happened May 1st, about 125 years ago. Each speaker reminded the people that what had brought them all there that day was that on May 1st of this year marked the 125th anniversary of the Haymarket Massacre. On May 1st of 1886 in Chicago, the Workshop of the World, where 340,000 workers took to the streets of Chicago, Milwaukee, Detroit, Cincinnati, St. Louis, Baltimore, Washington, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, and many other places. Some of the demands by the workers, which came out of the 2 years of planning by the Federation of Organized Trades and Labor Unions, the predecessor of the American Federation of Labor, were to increase wages, enforce the 1860s law for 8-hour workday, and laws on child labor. Nearly 200,000 workers actually went on strike. About 42,000 of those who fought that were on strike won the 8-hour workday. Another 150,000 got a shorter day than they had had before. And these were the makings of the revolution. In one case, though, on May 3rd, union steel workers were picketing and doing a lockout outside the gates of McCormick Reaper Factory in Chicago. Police intervened and began to club and fired upon the running strikers. In the end, two workers were killed and an unknown number of wounded. The following day, on May 4th, at the Haymarket Square, where there was a response to the police brutality, two workers, August Bees and Albert Parsons, and other speakers climbed on the hay wagon to address the crowd. Nearby, there were 180 police officers watching closely until they approached the men on the hay wagon, with the police captain, Bonfield, demanding that the men come down. even though they were exercising their right to free speech in a peaceful manner. But before things would end, an unknown person would toss a dynamite bomb into the group of police, killing one of them instantly, along with six other officers and four workers, due to the bomb and the riot that followed. A battle line was created, with the public wanting those behind the bombing brought to justice. This gave the police wanton power, unconditional support to call martial law, which was declared across the nation. In Chicago, 200 people were rounded up and arrested, including immigrants and political radicals. Civil liberties fell to the wayside. Warrants were not needed to raid the homes of these people. And it was the reason that anti-union forces were looking for to attack the labor movement. Eventually, eight men were arrested and brought to trial. Their names were August Spies, Albert Parsons, Adolf Fischer, George Engel, Louis Ling, Michael Schwab, Samuel Fielden, and Oscar Nieb. In the minds of the court and the jury, they were seen as guilty from the start. In the trial that followed, the eight anarchists were charged with conspiracy and accessory to murder. Their defense lawyer viewed the evidence against his defendants as weak, but they were still found guilty of murder. At their sentencing, Adolf Fischer made a statement before the people of the court saying, "I will only say that I protest against my being sentenced to death because I have committed no crime. I was tried here in this room for murder, and I was convicted of anarchy. I protest against being sentenced to death because I have not been found guilty of murder. But however, if I am to die on account of being an anarchist, on account of my love for liberty, fraternity, and equality, then I will not remonstrate. If death is the penalty for our love of the freedom of the human race, then I say openly, I have forfeited my life. But a murderer I am not, although being one of the parties who arranged the Haymarket meeting, I had no more to do with the throwing of that bomb. I had no more connection with it than the state's attorney, Grinnell, had, perhaps." After appeals to the Illinois and United States Supreme Courts failed, four of the defendants were executed on November 11, 1887. One day before the hangings, another defendant committed suicide. Then, Illinois Governor Richard Oglesby commuted the capital sentence of two other defendants to just life in prison. And one other defendant was sentenced by the jury for 15 years of hard labor. And then in June of 1893, the governor of Illinois pardoned three other men who were still alive. The Haymarket trials illustrated the oppressive time workers were facing and how people can become morally bankrupt when faced with fear. It was when the rules were not to be obeyed, and the only one can do to survive this failed system is to stand together. Out of the eight-hour struggle, which ended in the strike of May 1, 1886, and its result, the Haymarket tragedy, came International May Day. In Paris, France, on July 14, 1889, leaders from grassroots movements in many countries came together to create an international association of workers. At the first Congress of the Second International, delegates listened to the story related by the United States representatives, considered a request from the American Federation of Labor for support of their eight-hour flight, and voted to make May 1, 1890, a day for an international eight-hour day demonstration. So, as we stood there in the Forest Park Cemetery, in front of the monument, we too listened in silence to the band play while the statue was unveiled by Irving S. Abrahams, the last surviving member of the Pioneer Aid and Support Society, which had raised the money to erect the monument. As the wind picked up and we stood around, anarchist flags waving in the air, we stared at the face of liberty of workers standing over us. And I recall before this took place that Reverend Tim Yeager asked to observe those who lost their lives that month and following the months of May to remember the cause they died for.
That we will teach the lessons of Haymarket to our children. We will teach them in our schools and in our religious communities, and we will teach them in our union halls. Let the voice of the people be heard. Yeah. Let us resolve that from this day forward, we declare that May Day is an American worker holiday. It is our day, and we are taking it back. Let the voice of the people be heard. Yeah. And finally, let us resolve that from this day forward, whenever the 1st of May rolls around, that we will fill the streets of Chicago and New York and Los Angeles and march in solidarity with the workers of the world. Let the voice of the people be heard. Yeah. Thank you.
That was a good story, Mike. Now on to a lighter topic, the ego. You often hear or use the phrase, that person has a huge ego, or may have called someone an egotist. There's even the popular 2010 R&B song entitled Ego by Beyoncé. But what exactly does it mean to have one, and why is it all too often presented in a negative context? Egotism, conceit, selfishness, and self-importance are a few adjectives to describe what the ego is. The ego is your idea of yourself. One can feel good or bad depending upon whether the ego is deflated or inflated. According to the online article entitled Understanding the Ego Mind, the ego almost completely disregards the point of view of others and constantly tries to uphold one's own points of view. It is described as having a false center or state of mind. The ego is always judging who is superior or inferior to you. This comparison can make you feel good at times and bad at others. This false pride drives us toward greed and self-gratifying acts, which may for a short time leave us satisfied, but in the long run can leave us feeling void or disconnected. Some people may at times tell lies or exaggerate facts about themselves in order to prove themselves superior. A feeling to outcompete other people is ego-based and may produce envious feelings if others are perceived as more successful. Unfortunately, competitiveness can sometimes lead to a lack of appreciation for previous achievements. On an internet blog asking the question, why do we have an ego, an abstract answer was voted best. The person answering described the ego as having a master-beggar personality. To further explain this, a Buddhist story was given, and it goes as follows. A Zen master was passing through a street. A man came running and hit him hard. The master fell down, then got up, and started to walk in the same direction as he was going before, without even looking back. A disciple that was walking with the master was shocked. He asked the master who was the man, why he did it, and why the master didn't even bother to look back. The master simply said, "That's his problem, not mine." In this story, the ego is the man clashing into the enlightened Zen master. An interesting perspective, this suggests that the ego thrives on attention and the ego is always looking for some trouble. If no one pays attention to you, the ego feels hungry. If nobody pays attention and nobody thinks you are important or significant, how will your ego feel? Whether the attention is negative or positive doesn't matter. Any attention may be better than none. In this way, the ego is described as a deep, needing, and begging feeling. Unorthodox as this may seem, not everyone views the ego as a negative flaw. Like everything else, too much of anything can become a problem. Moderation is key. And a balance between ego and healthy self-esteem may be a lifelong process, as one cannot exist without the other. Another opinion states that the ego makes you feel important to yourself, but love makes you feel your importance to others. A good indicator that people are keeping their ego in check is compassion and an overall genuine concern for the well-being of others. Ego-driven motivation can create stress and worry, so if at times you're like me and struggling to be the best you can be, just remember to take it easy and realize you're doing better than you may feel. As the saying goes, life is about the journey, not the destination.
That was really cool, Rachel.
Thank you.
You're an ICC student?
Uh-huh.
You're an ICC student?
Uh-huh, yep.
How did you learn about this stuff?
All this I found on the internet. I wanted it to be more subjective, but what I found most interesting was other people's opinions and articles on the topic, so that's what I went with.
That's really cool. So when do you plan on contributing with us again?
With finals coming up and a hiking trip that I'm going to be going on, I probably won't be back for a month, but I do look forward to coming back.
That's great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, in Peoria news, Wednesday last week, in the community area, we had the opportunity to see some of our favorite local newscasters from TV's WEEK and WHOI standing up to keep our local news local, locally run, locally operated, and community-minded, against the efforts of corporate profit motivations, who would rather see the news outsourced and consolidated. We've got some actuality audio from this event. You might hear the familiar voices of Gary Moore and Eric Shangra. They were doing their part to motivate the crowd and send a message to their owners that this will not stand.
That's our way.
The people that own this station right now, that have the right to the airwaves that provide the information for all of you, they are a $6 billion equity company with holdings throughout North America, with holdings throughout Europe, and money, as we understand, the Grand Cayman Islands, one of those places you can stick money when you don't want anybody to know about it. They bought this station at a fire sale. The last group of people that ran this place ran Granite Broadcasting into the ground. And before they went to bankruptcy, they got in the pocket of Silver Point and borrowed all kinds of money. Then they went into bankruptcy and said to the judge, well, Silver Point said, we'll forgive the debt. We get to own all the stations, including Channel 25, and they're now ours. So they got us by default. And their bottom line now is to save money, and they want to save money by outsourcing the news, by being able to import the news from Fort Wayne or do what we're calling syndicated fake local news. And we need to let those people know at Silver Point it's not going to play in Peoria. We've been told this language is common throughout the country. Radio stations are syndicating the local news. Our state, our company in Fort Wayne, Indiana, is syndicating the local news to Detroit. It's happening everywhere. Well, in Peoria, Illinois, the people that work here in this newsroom and all of you are standing up and putting up a fight, and we're not going to let it happen. So thank you for standing with us and keeping it local.
I might fall off this. So. Thank you for all being here. This is important because local news means that a local community is informed, and if we allow this company to start dividing up and putting money over the interests of this community, then we all lose. You know, this. I was kind of thinking as we were listening to some of the stories that this kind of has a Wisconsin taste to it.
Yes!
You know what I mean? And I think we have to stop that because this stuff isn't going to play in Illinois. We have to make sure that what we in Illinois and in Peoria in particular do is support people like the folks from Channel 25 and Channel 19 and say no more. This is a local community issue. This is about economic democracy. When countries all across the world are trying to fight for democracy, we have to fight to keep it as well. And so let's fight and let's keep support.
Thanks, Steve. Well, let's start with this. When I say fired up, you say ready to go. Fired up!
Ready to go!
Fired up!
Ready to go!
Fired up!
Ready to go!
All right, that's the way I want to hear you talk. Look, folks, this is nothing but Wisconsin over again. This is about taking away from folks like you and me and giving it to the very well. This is all about money. Has nothing to do with this community in the sense that they could care less about the product they produce in this community so long as the money flows to them. So we have to stand together. The NAACP will be shoulder to shoulder with you through this issue as we have been with labor all over the country. So let's stand together. Let's fight this issue. Let's keep the news local. Let's keep the weather local. Let's keep the sports local. Thank you, and we are with you 100% of the way.
I want you to say,
uh-huh.
Now let's put the two of those together.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Now, the general manager's name is Mark DeSantis. When I point to the window, I want you to say, go Mark.
Go Mark.
Okay, now let's put the three of those together.
Yeah, uh-huh. Go Mark.
Okay, now, the last thing is you can do it. Because they're saying they can't take this out of the proposal. So we're going to say, yeah, uh-huh, go Mark, you can do it, okay?
Yeah, uh-huh, go Mark, you can do it. Yeah, uh-huh, go Mark, you can do it. Yeah, uh-huh, go Mark, you can do it. Yeah.
we encourage you to keep your ear to this story as it develops. I live in Peoria, and I'm facing a new commute. And I was very glad to meet Ryan Granada and CICarpool.org. In the fall, I'm planning on commuting to ISU and don't really want to drive three times a week. When I attended the Forest Park Nature Center Earth Day celebration and I came to the CICarpool.org booth, I was glad to learn about the resources available to me from their website. We are here at the Forest Park Nature Center Earth Day celebration. And you have a booth, you and your organization. Could you tell me more about CICarpool.org?
Yep. Ryan Granada.
All right, and you're with CICarpool.org?
Yes, and also Tri-County Regional Planning Commission.
All right, what's that?
We're the Regional Planning Commission for Peoria, Tazewell, Woodford counties. We do transportation planning, we do land use planning, we also do environmental planning and things like that. So I'm a planner with that organization. Carpool.org actually initially started back in 2008. The idea for it, when gas prices were high the last time, we were looking at, you know, $4.15 a gallon for gas. Worked with, at that time, it actually was an idea of, out in Morton. A couple of employers got together out there, were concerned about the high gas prices and the effect that they would have on their employees with recruitment, and were also worried that, you know, their employees may not be able to show up for work with gas prices as high as they were. Gas prices at that time did go back down in the fall of that year, but the employers out there realized that prices were going to go back up, and there needed to be some type of a tool. So they actually worked initially with the Morton Economic Development Commission to go forward this idea. In January 2009, the Morton EDC actually came to Tri-County and realized that to really have something like this work, it has to be a regional impact. So we worked it for about a year to get some grant funding, and we were fortunate to get some grant funding back in September of last year to actually launch this site. And we launched it back in January, and been kind of working with local employers at the time, but now we're trying to really get a push out to the general public. So that's kind of how we got started with that.
That's great. How many users do you normally see? What's the traffic flow like at CICarpool.org?
Right now, we're actually up to about 250 users. So we're very excited about that. We're very impressed, especially for us only being launched for about 4 months. So the system basically allows you to go on, put in your information of where you live and where you work, what times you take those trips, and the system will try to match you up with other people nearby who are making similar trips. You could also use it not only for carpooling. You can also use it if you were wanting to ride the bus with somebody, or even bike or walk to work. So it really accompanies all modes of transportation.
That is really cool. I like the idea. I'm glad it's been born right here in Central Illinois, as the name says, CICarpool.org.
Yeah, we're very excited about it. We think this is good for the environment. The system actually allows users to keep track of how often they carpool and what impact they actually have on that. When you actually look at even if you carpool just twice a week, and you have for an entire year, you could save about $1,000 a year just in gas prices, depreciation on your car, and you're looking at saving a significant amount in carbon emissions and things like that. So we're very excited about it, and hope we're glad that it will also not only save air quality, but also save some residents of Central Illinois some money. So we're very, very excited about this.
And on the website, you guys have a calculator that can help a user calculate their carbon footprint, their usage of their car, gasoline, and potentially their savings by carpooling with people around the community.
Yes, it does. That's a really neat feature of it. You don't even have to, you can actually see before you sign up on the site, you can actually use that service, say, I would probably carpool 3 days a week. I have a 30-mile round trip, and I get about this much miles per gallon, and the system will actually say, you're going to save about this much in gas, you're going to save about this much in carbon emissions and all that. So it's it really gives us some people, when they really see the tangible facts in front of them, it really begins to change some people's minds.
That's great. And signing up is as simple as providing an email address.
Initially, that's all you have to do. Basically, it's just like any other web form. You sign up, you give some information, your name, your email address, password, username, things like that. Once you actually go into the system, you set up your ride. You could go with something as simple as when you leave for work, when you come back from work, how many days a week you want to do it. If you want to be a rider or a driver, you could even get as personalized as, do you want to ride with a smoker, a non-smoker, or even somebody of the same gender. So there's some safety features also built into the site.
Oh, that's really nice.
Yeah.
I'm really glad this is going on. And once again, your name is?
I'm Ryan Granada, and I'm with the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission.
And you have about, there's no employees at CICarpool.org, but you have a plethora of an organizing team. You have a large, this is all built on?
Actually we do. We're very fortunate. We got a great partnership with several of the local chambers of commerce, the Peoria Area Chamber of Commerce, the Morton Chamber of Commerce, East Peoria, Washington. We also have several large employers that sit on our committee. We've got somebody from OSF, we've got somebody from Cat Logistics out in Morton, we've got, we've got Morton Industries, this is a unique idea because this really actually came from businesses and not actually from, another organization. So we've been very fortunate to work with them and to have their support on this.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
After I met Ryan at the Forest Park Nature Center and his CICarpool.org team, I took his advice and I went to their website and I made an account and I set up my trip from Peoria to Bloomington for school, and I got 10 matches of people who take similar trips throughout the week, and I'm hoping that I won't have to drive as much as the fall semester approaches. And I encourage anybody listening to visit CICarpool.org, play with it and see what you can find. Well, that's our show for today. In observation of May Day, we've done our best to show our listeners what it is and what it's all about. Thanks for tuning in. This has been WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica Radio affiliate and the home of Solidarity Journal. Thanks for listening.
I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union until the day I die.